Our guest today, one of the best capital allocators of our generation and, of course, in history. Mr. David Cicurel, with matches or compound rate of almost 30% for almost 20 years.
It's very different from judges because we're trying to buy only very good companies and keep them good. You know, you have to understand there's three things which are key to this being a good sector, to doing a buy and build. One is enormous growth worldwide in university education, and this is going to carry on for many, many, many years. And the other one is the desire of everybody who does anything to optimize what they're doing. And of course, we make the instrument to measure a lot of stuff. So on average, you get 20% on your money. And in the last few years, you know, you were paying 4%. So it's very good, but you need to convert in your profits into cash. If you can make a potato chip for half the price, you're going to sell it to all the supermarkets and make good money. But niches is the thing.
Good riches.
I have no doubt about this. That value creation is best if you don't issue a lot of shares and do this arbitrage. So it's a valid model, but it's not at all as powerful as buying with debt and repaying the debt. That, you know, all the shareholders are equal, like we respect them all the same, but we have a soft touch in our heart for those who find us.
Could you tell us two to three companies that you like that would be interesting to be analyzed or you like to be investing in, apart from just Scientific, of course?
Tu Dinero en Acción, episodio 71. Hola, soy Javier Acción, asesor financiero independiente autorizado y registrado en la Comisión Nacional del Mercado de Valores con el número 149 y asesor del fondo de inversión Acción Global. Te doy la bienvenida a Tu Dinero en Acción, tu podcast de inversión, donde hablaremos de manera sencilla y cercana de conceptos, métodos y alternativas para rentabilizar tus ahorros. Si te planteas sacarle partido a tus ahorros o quieres descubrir qué opciones te interesan más, te invito a quedarte para aprender sobre finanzas con un lenguaje directo y sin tecnicismos. Si tienes alguna pregunta, duda o sugerencia, puedes contactar con nosotros utilizando las distintas vías que encontrarás en nuestra página web www.accioninversiones.com.
El contenido de este podcast es divulgativo. Las opiniones aquí expuestas son meramente informativas y en ningún caso suponen una recomendación de inversión. Si buscas asesoramiento financiero, debes dirigirte a cualquiera de los asesores autorizados y registrados en la Comisión Nacional del Mercado de Valores.
La entrevista que estáis a punto de escuchar se ha grabado en inglés, al ser la lengua materna de nuestro invitado. Podéis verla subtitulada en español en vídeo.
In today's episode of Tu Dinero en Acción, we are lucky enough to be able to interview the founder and CEO of Just Scientific, one of the core positions in our Acción Global fund. We invest firstly in the company in September 2018 at a stock price between 20 and 25 pounds per share, being currently trading at 92 pounds per share, which is rate for our savings of 30% per annum compounded. This rate is no coincidence because although we have enjoyed only these last 5 years, our guest today founded the company almost 20 years ago with £2 million, being currently a company of more than £600 million in market cap, going the share between £2 to £92 per share, with matches or compound rate of almost 30% for almost 20 years. And of course, it makes our guest today one of the best capital allocators of our generation and, of course, in history. Mr. David Cicurel, thank you so much for being with us today on our humble podcast, Tu Dinero en Acción.
Yeah, and Javier, thank you very much for inviting me, and I'm here with you.
You know, you are one of the goats, right? One of the best capital allocators of all time.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe I am of all time, but I'm happy to be one of the good ones this year and in the last 20 years. But I think, of course, we have great geniuses like Warren Buffett, who I think we all follow with admiration and who inspires all the capital allocators who are worth anything. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of other capital allocators, but we're happy with what with our performance up to now.
Okay. We are trying only always to look for sleep well positions for our portfolio. So how can we go find 20 other CEOs like you for our portfolio to be sleeping well and compounded at 30% for many years? Is it possible? What do you think?
Yeah, well, cloning is a solution, but outside cloning, I think it's really, you know, you need a bit of luck. You need to find them. And I'm sure, you know, actually a lot of people find us doing screens and looking at the performance over a number of years. And I think that's how you find. And then you have to meet them and understand what makes the business work. You know, because sometimes you have people have fantastic performance, but you know, and you can make fantastic returns in mining or in oil or in high tech, but you can't always explain what will work and what will not work. You know, like you don't want a dry well, but how do you do that? You right. want something under the earth. So with us, it's different because you can observe what we've done. And then I think, yeah, to find other capital allocators, you have to meet with them and try to understand, to ask them how they do it. And if it's complicated, go somewhere else.
Okay. Okay, so moving on to more serious topics, could you please give us a little bit of background from you? How did you come to found Just Scientific?
Well, you know, I spent half my life in France. I moved to Britain because I was a big fan of Margaret Thatcher. I worked a lot with public companies. I was a company doctor most of my life, so it was very different from judges because we're trying to buy only very good companies and keep them good. But most of my life, I was looking for bad companies and trying to make them good. So it's a completely different exercise. But I became involved with rescuing a couple of public companies. And then I had this theme of taking public companies private because I did it with one of the companies that I had turned around. And this is how we created Judges in 2003. And of course, the market became very friendly to small public companies. And, so we changed completely our theme and we looked for acquisition. And I have to say, you know, I was blessed to find FTT among many, many, many acquisition targets that I looked for over a period of more than a year. And I found, you know, this was a company which was very small, but it was producing £750,000 EBIT with 3 million sales and only 19 people. And I thought that's an extraordinary thing. So I went to see the owners and they explained to me what they were doing. And the thing I thought was particularly attractive is that they were dominating the world. You know, this was a £3 million company, which had no solid competition. They had three small competitors and that was it. So I thought, you know, we had a company with £2 million of net worth at the time, which we had raised the money at 95p in 2003. And so if you could dominate the world with this sort of money, that would be great, you know. So I bought it. It was largely debt-based because I had no traction in the city at all. But I had traction with one bank that I'd worked with for 15 years and they hadn't lost money with me in many ventures. So they backed me quite generously at the beginning. And that's it. We bought our first company, and really, if we look at our sector, because of course we checked all these things before we bought it, but you know, you have to understand there's three things which are key to this being a good sector to doing a buy and build. One is you have to have good drivers. And we have excellent drivers. One is enormous growth worldwide in university education. And this is going to carry on for many, many, many years. And the other one is the desire of everybody who does anything to optimize what they're doing. People want to optimize everything. And you can't optimize what you haven't measured. So these two things, and of course, we make the instrument to measure a lot of stuff. So these two things are there for many, many decades, and they're really the thing which drive our growth. And we had, until COVID, we had annual compound growth, organic, of 9%. So it was quite good. When you buy mature businesses, it's quite good. If you buy startups, it's really not very good. But if you buy mature businesses producing profits and cash, 9% is not bad. And of course, it's a bit lower now, it's around 7% because the COVID has left some scars. But, you know, so that was the first thing, very good drivers. The second thing is you need deals. So I found before I bought FTT that there were 2,000 companies in our sector in the UK. And of course, there's a lot of companies in the world. And this is a global business completely. I mean, the fact we're in the UK has nothing to do with where we sell our instruments. Most of them are sold worldwide. And so we found there were 2,000 companies. So it looked like we would find a lot of deals. And the third thing was that there was very little capital utilization. So some people say, well, you're only buying goodwill. Yeah, we were only buying goodwill. So the balance sheet doesn't look great. But the fact is you can grow these companies. You don't need to invest a lot of money to grow them. And we have really, we have usually about 80, 90% conversion of our EBITDA into cash, which is very important when the model is driven by debt, because you need to, you borrow, you buy companies on a reasonable multiple. I mean, the first few deals we did were 4%, 4x EBIT. And if you exclude Geotech, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, if you exclude Geotech, which is the last big deal we did, all the other companies, on average, we paid 5x. So on average, you get 20% on your money. And in the last few years, you know, you were paying 4%. So it's very good, but you need to convert in your profits into cash. Otherwise, you have to issue shares. And the big secret is don't issue a lot of shares. Shares are very precious. You know?
Later, we are going to talk about this kind of stuff, of course. 20% deployment of return for your capital plus organic growth plus the leverage is an outstanding return for savings. But going back to the basics, because we like in our podcast to build the house from the floor to the roof. So for those few listeners of our podcast who don't know yet your company, going to the basics, what does Just Scientific do? Explain us, give a short briefing of the business of the company, please.
Yeah, the business is really large, there's a few exceptions, but the business is about scientific instruments. And scientific instrument doesn't mean medical instruments. So we don't do any medical instrument. There's none of our instruments need, for instance, to be authorized by the FDA. And we don't use our instrument on people. Okay, so the instruments are largely for scientific research. So it's researchers in university and research centers in industrial companies, you know, like telecom companies or like pharmaceutical companies, and they're looking at things through a microscope, but of course it's a very sophisticated microscope, so we make, you know, accessories for that. And, right. and so it's largely researchers, and it's also sometimes about compliance. So the world is organized with, you know, a lot of compliance issues. So a lot of products you can't sell in various countries if they don't comply with some rules. So the first company we bought was about fire. So of course you can't put, you know, you can't put furniture or you can't put building materials or cable in a building or in a plane or in a boat if it's very flammable. So you need to analyze everything you sell to be able to sell it to around the world and comply with these standards. And so we produce also instrument to check the compliance with these standards. So it's really to check compliance, to improve your products, and to invent new things, basically.
Perfect.
So
Perfect.
It's largely about research and compliance.
Sounds good. Thanks for that. You probably know that there is a common sentence in the financial community that says that niches get riches. Why is it important for Just Scientific to invest in niches where the big players are not interested in competing with you? And was it a deliberate decision in your early days to be focused in niches?
Yeah, I mean, clearly, I felt because we, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, you know, domination is always a good thing. Okay. So if you have a lot of money, you can say, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to, you know, invest, you know, billions in, say, semiconductors, because today, you know, what do you want to do? Semiconductors, that's the thing. But it's really not a very small niche. But if you have billions, you're going to do it.
Yeah, right.
You know, there's a lot of demand. I think 90% of the semiconductors are made in China or Taiwan. And if these two countries, if I'm allowed to call them countries, because one of them doesn't accept the other one is a country, but if they go to war, then we all, you know, we won't be able to do anything, you know, like use our phones, use our cars, turn on the light in the morning. So of course, everybody wants to build semiconductors. It looks like a no-brainer, but you need billions and billions. So if you have little money, like we had 2 million, then I think you have to look for niches. Yes. Or then you have to have some other, you have to do something better than other people, really. So, you know, if you can make something which is not niche, but you have found a way to make it a lot cheaper, even if it's a product which is, you know, available everywhere and thousands of companies sell it, this is fine. You know, if you can make a potato chip for half the price, you're going to sell it to all the supermarkets and make good money. But niches is the thing.
Get riches.
Mostly if you're in Europe, in a country where everything is expensive to make, you need a niche.
And going with the M&A, you say that you've done many acquisitions in your history, but probably M&A is a core part of your business, deploying capital. If you had to choose the most important factor between the price you pay for a company when you acquire, it means the rate at which you are deploying the capital and the underlying quality of the business you are acquiring in the form of organic growth in the years following the acquisition, which of the both will you choose, or do you think is more important for the returns?
Yeah, I mean, quality is, of course, important. We would not deliberately buy anything which is not super quality, okay? Super quality is the thing. Now, you need to look at a lot of deals and to find some with great quality. Now, the question is, pricing is also very important because, as I've explained, you know, like if you can pay 5 times or even 4 times, which is even better, And for a big deal, 7 times is not bad. And I'll get onto that if you wish. But if you can pay 5 times, you get 20% on your money. It's good. And of course, even with the interest rates that you have today, it's still good. Well, it's a bit less good, but it's good. So price is very important because the problem, if you pay too much for your deals, is that you run out of money quicker and you have to issue shares. So the whole, the whole construction is based on paying moderate prices and financing the company with debt. You know, occasionally we issue shares.
On cash flows and debt.
Yeah, cash flows and debt. Yeah. I mean, the cash flow repays the old debt, but you always have to have new debt. And now we have a £100 million facility, so we have access to a lot of debt. But we, from day one, we had good access to debt, and it's been very cheap. I mean, but when we started, debt was more expensive than it is today. Okay, and the debt we pay, we borrowed, of course, a lot of money, like £50 million in the last balance sheet. Yeah. At a time when it seems that debt is not so cheap, but it was still cheap because we froze the interest rate the month after we did the Geotech acquisition. So, but it's still good. The business model is still good. But theoretically, with debt being more expensive, you should pay less.
Quality, but at reasonable price, right?
Yeah. Quality and price, so you need to find a lot of deals. So the next question is, why do you do such few deals? Well, you have the answer. You have to look at all the deals and then you eliminate all those when you're not happy with the quality. And you're never sure 100%, So yeah. Not all our companies are of the same quality, but most of them are. And once you're sure of the quality, you try to buy them at a good price. So what is the creation of the good price? I have to say, why people, they're not idiots. Why do they sell it at a good price if they're such good quality? And the answer is virtually always the same, is they are for sale. If you try to pick the companies you want to buy and you go and make an offer at a price, most things are for sale. But it's a high price. But if you try to buy the companies which are for sale, it's a different thing. And the reason people want to sell them is because they're old. and so when people want to retire, they have to do something. I mean, nobody wants to leave a widow with a company to sell which has no management. That's not a good business model.
That's the perfect setup for going for them and buying quality at good prices, right?
That's it. So they put their companies for sale and we're there. And if we find a good quality, we usually find, find a reasonable price.
Okay, perfect. As you probably know, there is a common saying in the industry or in the financial community that David Sicurelli is very, very conservative in the multiples he pays for the companies that you are acquiring. And of course, the low price gives you a great margin of safety in the return on investment. But it's also has been said that if you raise a bit your hurdle rate, you could have done more deals and then you would have deployed more capital. What would you say to those guys?
Yeah, I think they're right. We would have more size. It's interesting. When people started looking at Judges in 2009, because before that, nobody wanted even to see us. I'm talking about investors. And so people ask me that typical question is, where do you want to be in 5 years? Do you want to be like a £100 million company or whatever? At the time, we were like a £3 million company. And I said, I don't care. What I would like is my shares to be £10. That would be a good result because at the time, our shares were one and a bit. And
well, you get short of your expectation.
And eventually, 5 years later, I don't think we were at 100 million. I think we had sales of about 20 million, something like this. But our shares were £20. So we beat that target. So, you know, we would go faster, undoubtedly, by being less disciplined with price. And we would, you know, we would spend more of our cash. But, you know, eventually, and we could be a £1 billion company, undoubtedly, because there's a lot of deals around. But then, of course, we would have issued a lot more shares. So that is really the question. So the real task that we have is to really spend the majority of the money we can spend on deals. That's what we call deal equity. Okay.
Okay.
So the bank will lend us 3x EBIT. So if you knock off what you already, actually EBITDA, I don't know why they believe in EBITDA, but it's good for us. So we accept it. And if you knock off, the debt you already have, that's basically your deal equity that you can spend on deals. And every deal brings its own new borrowing with it. So we don't want to spend all our deal equity because it's tied to EBITDA over the last 12 months. So if you have a bad period, you start breaching your covenants. So we want to be cautious. At this point, we're a bit more cautious because the world is not a happy place. So we want to be a bit more, we've been a bit more cautious recently than we were before. But the challenge is to spend a good proportion of that deal equity.
Okay. Okay.
And there's period where we have a lot, there's period where we don't have a lot, but everybody can calculate it from our accounts. And for instance, in 2017, we didn't have any. So there was a period from 2017 where people were telling me, you should be a bit more aggressive in what you pay. And, I realized we realized we were not able to find enough deal and that from time to time we need to do a big deal. Okay. If you do a big deal and you pay a bit more, then that's okay because it doesn't pollute the other deals that you were doing before. You see, if in the past for a company making 2 million, you pay 6x and you start paying 7x for it, people would always want 7x. But if you buy something bigger that you haven't really been buying before, it's not so bad. So we thought that from time to time you do a big deal, and Geotech was one of these big deals, and then it uses a lot of deal equity, and that's what we want. But we could go much faster, and we could do every year a Geotech, maybe not at 7x, except it was a good deal, but then we'd run out of money, and we'd issue shares. And the cost of shares is, as you said, it's 30%.
Okay. Later we will talk about dilution, but we have a common set here in Spain that said no puedes hacer una tortilla sin romper algunos huevos. That is that you cannot make a Spanish tortilla without breaking some eggs. And of course, when you are making these kind of decisions through 20 years, of course, there are mistakes. So could you give us a couple of examples of businesses that you acquired that following years, things go much better than you expected and things go much worse than you expected and why that happened?
Look, I think... I'm going to give you examples, only the ones which are good. But, you know, one of the examples that we have is a company that we bought in 2009. It's called Quorum. And 2009, you know, our shares were 60 pence. Okay, so we were just in the aftermath of the meltdown. And... the company was making, was going to make something like 500,000. So we bought it on the basis of 500,000, including an earnout. And we paid 3 times. Sure. So we paid $1.5 million for that. And it makes, you know, this is a company which makes, you know, several times what we paid every year.
Today.
You know? That's a company which is, you know, I would say...
A big success.
A total star. If you look at, you know, up to Geotech, we were producing something like 30% return on total invested capital. So that includes goodwill and all this accounting rubbish that people usually take off from their accounts. They don't have to produce a return on money that they've written off. It's a very comfortable thing to be in, but we don't believe in comfort. So we produce, you know, typically a ROTIC of 30%. When you do a big deal like Geotech, it just, you know, brings it down to 22 in that
particular case.
And you have to work hard to get it back to 30. But this is the sort of thing. So what I want to say is, if you look at Quorum, this is completely off the scale in terms of the ROTIC that it
produced. Okay.
But it was special circumstances. And because, you know, nobody was buying anything at the time, you know,
right.
So we were able to pay 3 times. But look, we have a lot of fantastic companies, and we have some companies which are less than fantastic. And so I'm not naming them because they have competitors and you don't want to encourage your competitors.
Okay.
But they're not all great. But I have to say, first of all, it is very, very rare that we have any company in any year losing money. You know, when I was saying, you know, some companies can be difficult, they have difficult. I mean, I exclude COVID, but sometimes they have difficult times. But they're not all of the quality sometimes that we perceived. And some have, you know, over a period of 18 years, the quality can actually sometimes deteriorate. So, for instance, we bought one company in very, very early stages of Judges, and it was very, very niche. And in the following years, we had more competition coming, you know, first from Eastern Europe and then from China, and it became a bit less niche. So, you know, at one point I was thinking, you know, maybe we have to accept it's not what we bought, and do we want to keep it or we don't want to keep it? But, you know, we hired a new MD, but the previous MD was very good, but, you know, he was poached. And we hired a new MD, and we really, he's done a fantastic job. But really, I told him, look, you know, this business is less niche than it was, so you really have to find, among the niche that was, there are some core niches, something really difficult. You have to do difficult stuff. You know, you can't do things that are easy, but if you manage to concentrate on the difficult stuff, and then he's done that, and he's done everything perfectly. So even in the non-niche, he makes good money compared to what was made before. So this is a company which has deteriorated from what we bought. And yeah, we have one company that we feel, with hindsight, probably we wouldn't have bought, you know, and... So we're really trying to, you know,
okay.
We suffered a lot with COVID, and we, you know, we need to keep working on it till it's good enough, and maybe one day we'll sell it.
Okay. So not so many eggs you broke in 20 years.
No, we didn't make a lot of
that's
eggs.
That's fine.
But we bought some eggs. You know, an American university did a study. It says, what's the optimum rate of failure? You know? And they came to the conclusion it was 15%. You say 0%. Who wants
15%.
To fail?
No.
Because if you have 0%, you're not trying hard enough. And then if you have 30%.
You are doing only easy things.
Yeah, that's it. So you have, you know, if you try hard enough, you're going to break some eggs. By the way, the French say the same as the Spaniards. So.
Okay. When you are gaining scale, you need larger acquisitions like Geotech to move the needle. But what is your TAM, your total addressable market going forward, to keep acquiring good niche companies at scale? Is it a big time of this kind of niches to be acquired?
Yeah, I think it's big, but we don't. Not every year we find enough deals. That's what I'm saying. So that's you have to eventually buy some bigger companies, and you have to buy also abroad. So we found that in the UK, where it's fantastic for us. The reason we bought, you know, mostly UK companies with two small exceptions is because we can buy them at good multiples, you know. And in continental Europe, people don't think so much in terms of EBIT multiple. And we found that it's been difficult to complete deals in continental Europe. And then, of course, there's America and Canada, where they do think in terms of EBIT multiple, but unfortunately, everything is like 2 points higher. So for the same thing, we pay 6 times, we have to pay 8 times in the US, and it's more complicated, and there's more tax, and in the end, it hasn't been good.
Okay.
But now there's more tax in the UK, so that's different, because tax is going up here and on there.
Yeah.
But what I say is the equation has been best in the UK, and we haven't exhausted the UK. There's every year there's new deals coming. But of course, yes, we our worldwide TAM is much, much bigger. And there will be a phase. Look, I have no doubt if we spoke in 20 years when I'm 94, I will tell you that we've been buying big companies and paying more than I like to pay.
I wish
you have to pay more.
We will talk later about your subscription plans, but I wish we will talk in 20 years and you have 20 more years of compound at this rate.
But just to say, Javier, you know, a company for which we have much admiration is Halma. And actually we have two of our 4 executive directors were with Halma, so we admire it even more. You know, it's much bigger. It's in the FTSE 100. At one point, it was worth 10 billion.
Yeah.
And of course, so when I talk about the, you know, they also have, of course, the big generation of deal equity.
Okay.
And they buy several companies every year. And they pay, you know, worth 30 billion, 30 million. $40 million dollars. A lot is in the States because they find bigger things there. And they just so manage it and they pay 12 times.
Okay.
And of course, you would say, but why do you pay 12 times? Because today, you know, interest rates where they are, it doesn't leave you much margin. No?
Yeah, right.
If you pay 12 times EBIT, you know, like you get 8% on your money, you pay tax, you're left with 6%. You know, can you borrow 6%?
Yeah.
Nobody borrows 6%. So it's not a good margin. But the problem is that that's generating a lot of cash. And it's not only a question of spending the deal equity. It's a question of spending their cash because the cash in the bank doesn't give you 6%.
Yeah, right. With a little leverage plus the organic growth, it's a good investment, but not like that.
No. Halma is fantastic.
okay.
What I'm saying is in 20 years, we would like to be in the FTSE 100.
Okay. Later.
In the position we have to pay more.
Later, I'll ask you about the companies that you like. But talking about dilution, you talked previously about this crucial thing that is the dilution, and there are great investors in the history that have said that the worst mistake they made was to finance some of their acquisitions through their own shares because of what it means through the years later after a big, very, very, very big compound. On the opposite, we have some companies that try to benefit from this kind of multiple arbitrage, paying with shares that are trading at 20 times to buy companies that are trading at 10 times with that magical generation of value. And on the other hand, for the equity returns if you finance the acquisition with debt, I don't know, between 2 to 5% depending on the cycle interest rate. For your equity, is a very good generation of value, but we have the balance risk here, right? So what do you think about all of this between your own shares, your cash flows and debt for the value creation in the long term?
I think that, you know, I have no doubt about this, that value creation is best if you don't issue a lot of shares. I recognize 100% the model of the typical buy and build model, which is an arbitrage between your multiple and the multiple of what you're buying. I recognize it's very successful, and you could get, if you have good city backing, that we didn't have at the beginning because we couldn't find anybody who wanted our shares, but now I think we have a reasonable reputation, and I think we could grow at fantastic speed by issuing a lot of shares to buy other companies and do this arbitrage. So it's a valid model, but it's not at all as powerful as buying with debt and repaying the debt. It's not. But of course, the world changes, and people of your generation that just, you know, they don't know what high interest rate is. I mean, you don't know. You haven't, you know, like 30 years ago, had a mortgage at 15%.
Yeah, my parents also.
you knew that you. Now we sleep at night, but when you have to pay 15% on your mortgage, you. But of course, there was then inflation also. So, yeah. You know, the world is changing from what you've known a lot of your working life. And I'm not saying that when I say that's the model, when I say, but in what we've known in the last 18 years, definitely the model of arbitraging the return on what you buy against the interest that you pay is much, much, much more powerful than the model of arbitraging share multiples.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, we would not have achieved the 33% return annually compound for our shareholders if we had done this other model, but we'd be probably in the FTSE already, and we could pay ourselves big salaries.
Yeah. And the problem with the dilution is if you are saying to the market that the businesses that you are buying are deserves to be valued at 10 times, eventually your share is going to trade at 10 times too. So the value creation disappears. So that's the big problem with the dilution. Yeah. Of course, I'm totally agree with that. And about the dividend, I know that a large proportion of UK and British investors love to receive a dividend, but there are other investors who think that apart from not being very well treated fiscally, they would prefer to decide if when they trim a bit of the share, and that in the meantime, it will be you who manage that money capitalizing the returns and making more compound. And if you do not pay that dividend, you have more cash to deploy. Sorry. Without paying a dividend, what do you think between deploying more capital or giving the money to investors for his pockets?
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult one. You know, I have more debate on this than any other topic when I talk to shareholders, because my most favorite shareholders, who are big followers of Berkshire, they're always the one who says, why do you pay dividend? It's not good capital allocation. Okay? So what I want to say is, the first thing I want to say is, a lot of people ask me, and what about share buybacks? So for me, dividend versus share buyback is a very simple question. Is dividends are neutral in terms of pricing, you know, like whether your shares are £2, or £300, yeah, it's the same. You know, the dividend is the difference. In terms of share buybacks, you know, if you find your shares are really cheap, then you should buy them back rather than pay a dividend. And if you think your shares are expensive, it's not the case. I'm not saying our shares are, I'm not saying our shares are expensive, but you can't say they're cheap. You know, our shares are not cheap. I think there are reasons why they're not cheap.
And of course. Think
it is the 33% return. Why do you sell them when you can, next year you made 33%? So that doesn't come cheap. But, so this is why, you know, in the early days where they were really cheap, we tried to buy some shares, but we didn't succeed. We didn't find any.
Yeah, but the liquidity of a stock is not very high, so the buybacks are not on the table here, I think, no?
But a lot of people ask me, why do you do this? Because in America, they much prefer buybacks. So, but of course, there's a question of keeping the money and spending it. So, you know, as I said, you know, it's not like we can spend twice as much at the same return as what we have. And we're not, you know, typically we only, you know, we're only distributing to shareholders maybe 20-25% maximum of our income. So it hasn't really interfered and it hasn't consumed our deal equity to an extent that it has prevented us to grow. Okay. But I have to say, you know, my idea of dividend is this thing. We like long-term holders, you know. You're starting to be a longish term holder compared to a lot of others.
Okay, you know? This month we are 5 years old.
That's it.
Yeah. But yeah, a little boy, but starting to grow.
Okay, and I think not paying a dividend is not a fantastic way to keep long term holders because, of course, the markets go up and down. You know, you can deliver performance, but there's times when the markets are poor, and you know, I saw our shareholders in 2009. I was talking about 2009, and some of them who had been there from the beginning, 95p, and the company was doing extremely well, and they had to sell the shares at 60p because the market was just so bad. So you're just making, you know, you're really making the long-term holder, if you don't pay a dividend, you're making the long-term holder entirely dependent on the market, you know?
Right.
And we're not so modest. We think we're doing well for our shareholders, but we're not saying we will always do well, you know, like anybody can have an accident. But the market can have also accidents. And if you don't pay dividend, then they're entirely in the hands of the market.
So no, I understood.
This is something which was... And I have to say, you know, when I was in business school, we had a very good finance teacher, and he was asking, you know, what's the value of the shares? Everybody thought they were clever. He said, I know, you read it in the FT every day.
Yeah.
And that was in France, by the way. But still, they were talking about the FT. And he said, no. That's the price of the shares. But the value is the compound value of all future dividends at a suitable interest rate.
Tangible cash.
That is that when you buy the shares, you buy the right to have all these future dividends.
Yeah, of course.
And if you discount them at that proper discount rate, that's your value. But of course, it's not true if you pay zero. You can't
and
say.
And the price is what anyone else is able to pay for this value.
Exactly. But that is like, it doesn't depend on other people buying you out. And I thought this stayed with me always. You know, you have a few things that you see when you're very young and you're starting with business, you remember them. And, you know, I would say they're on the fingers of a hand. And that's one of the things I always remember. And I think, yes, if you have a cash generative business and you pay dividend, people never need to sell the shares. But I'm not saying they shouldn't sell the shares. And we think it's legitimate to take profits sometimes, but you're not relying on the market exclusively. So that's the debate. But look, we have You know, the individual shareholders in England like a dividend. There are some funds which are tax-driven. They're called VCTs. I don't know whether you're familiar with that, venture capital trusts, that if they invest and they keep the shares for a long time, they can never sell them because they would have to buy some companies which are more speculative because they need money. Yeah. And so really, they're never selling them. We have a few VCTs who never sold any shares. So you don't give them a dividend, what do they have?
Yeah, you know? Of course.
But I realized that in some areas and some stores, and of course the institutions don't pay tax on these dividends. So it's not good for everybody. And I have to be honest, you know, it's me, you know, I love paying a dividend.
Is your a part of the salary?
No, I mean, like, you know, I mean, most of my income comes from the dividends. So.
Okay.
I think some people say, you know, once I had a guy coming to the shareholders meeting, he said, I thought I'd never say that, but you're not paying yourselves enough, the board.
Okay.
You know, but the truth is, you know, when whatever I make, which is from a dividend, nobody is ever unhappy with it because they're making the same. No? Okay. I like to be on the side of shareholders.
Okay. And talking about Geotech, that has been the largest acquisition in your history. In fact, you said that you deployed as much capital in this acquisition that in all the previous one, in all history of Just the Scientific. So some investors might seem a little risky to concentrate so much capital in one acquisition. So how is it performing since you acquired it? Versus your expectations?
Yeah, so I would say yes. I mean, I have to say, first of all, you know, you're right, you know, we spend as much as on all the others. Secondly, you know, typically it would produce like half of what all the others are producing because we've had the others for a long time and with growth.
Of course.
And also because we paid more. So yeah. I've explained why we were looking for a big deal. I think the multiple for a deal of this size was really, you know, very favorable to us because we thought for a deal of that size, we'd have to pay more. And it's due, I think, to the circumstances of the deal and the fact that they'd put the company for sale before COVID and they had to pull the sale. You know, they had a buyer and they had to pull the sale because of the uncertainty of COVID. And they could come back and speak to us on a very confidential fashion without taking the risk that, you know, it wouldn't work. And then they failed twice. And the guy turned 70. You know, like once you've decided you want to sell and you're a certain age, you really want to sell and you don't want to wait. I think if he'd gone through another process, he would have had a better multiple. But, you know, he pocketed something like 60, 70 million, and he's 70. What is it better to get another 10 million and you're 72 with all the risk? Well, you know, business has risk. So he wouldn't be richer, but he was taking more risk.
Okay.
So that is why we were lucky because, you know, one of our directors knew their managing director very well from Oxford Institute. So I think on the figures, it was a good deal. It was an unusual deal, and I have to say, you know, it feels a bit more risky because of the size, because of the fact that it has something different from what we usually do, which is services. So that's a bit different because there's services is a different thing. And we, you know, now we have an operation in the States, we have an operation in Brazil. So services tend to be a bit more localized than.
It serves not the capex, but the opex of your clients, right?
Yes. So a third of the business is what we always do, a third of the business is services. And that includes a bit of rental. Because mining companies don't like capex. So I would say, although it's services, But it's really CapEx turned into OpEx, so we don't care. And you're talking about big companies. They're really big companies who will pay us. And sometimes they pay very good rental because they just don't like to invest in capital. But some others are services which are, you know, which are quite stable. It's the digitalization of cores. And we think it's a fantastic thing that, you know, a lot of mining and oil companies should do. Because, of course, you know, if you have a good understanding of the soil where you've been taking some samples, it helps you a lot if you want to dig again or drill again. You know, so the analysis of that information is absolutely critical because getting these cores is extremely expensive.
Okay.
You really want to squeeze a maximum of information from that. So that is very good, and it's quite a steady business. And then you have what we call coring, which is really about understanding gas hydrates. I won't get into big development on all that, but it's an enormous quantity of energy is stored under gas hydrates, which is a combination of methane and water under certain condition of pressures. And analyzing these cores is very difficult, but we have the device which enables you to extract these cores and analyze them as still gas hydrates without them being destroyed when they come outside. So that is, I would say, the most volatile part of our business throughout Judges. Because you need to, you basically, you can do one campaign a year, not much more. And they've had campaigns every year except COVID, but it happened, may happen that we don't have one.
Okay. You talk about volatile revenues, but some investors may think that being related to geothermal analysis, which is related to industries like oil and gas, mining companies. So there's a bit more cycle exposure than the other businesses of Judges. Is that true? There is some cyclicality here?
Yeah, you know, I would say the mining and oil industry is a bit more cyclical. It's not only that, like, for instance, the coring is not at all, it's government driven. You know, it's basically government doing that coring. It's very, at a very stage, we sell a lot also to universities. It's not only, you're not talking about only, you know, about companies which are operating mines and gas fields. But it is true. But you have to say, we have other businesses which have some cyclicality, generally there's a bit less cyclicality when you sell to universities than when you sell to
companies, mining
companies, because we sell capital goods and capital goods. You know, the first thing that when things are not going well, the first thing companies do is stop CapEx. You know, that's in big multinational groups, that's what it is. You know, you stop CapEx. So we sell capital goods. But of course, there's also different ups and downs in universities and research labs because of budgets, you know. And we've suffered that since 2008, so most of our life. And then after COVID, it's going to be the same because governments spent too much. Or when they spent a lot, they were saving lives. I'm not saying they shouldn't have spent it, but they spent a lot. The thing which they did wrong is I think that they didn't say, look, guys, you know, we're paying you to stay at home 80% of your salary, and you can stay at home and have barbecues and do your lawns. Very good. I mean, they were right. It saves many lives. They were right to do it. What wasn't right is to say, by the way, this is not our money because governments don't have money. This is your money. And we'll have to pay it back one day.
Yeah.
And now I think, you know, a lot of governments are just falling over. Right wing, left wing, it has nothing to do with it. It's because people, because none of them was honest enough to say, we're giving you your money in advance, and it's money you won't have later.
Yep.
And so, these enormous deficits that people are just wondering today, how do you stop them growing rather than, you know, national debts rather than paying it back? And you know, this is something which over the next few years will have impact on research spend.
Okay. And during these 20 years, you have gone through many cycles and here we are. So that's a normal part of the business.
So, and a nice part of our business is that, of course, we're very international and you don't have, these cycles are not, they're not correlated, you know.
Yeah,
no, so at some point, you know, you'd have stimulus in the US, but in the UK, they're tightening the belts of the government. So it's been okay, you know.
Yeah, the cadence between cycles are not the same, so...
Exactly.
Okay. And talking about the future, of course, some investors may think that Just Scientific has a heavy dependence on David Sicurel. And how are you? 73 years old are you right now?
I'm 74 now.
74. So how you feeling,
get
David?
Well,
how you feeling, David? Are you with energy and decide to go on for a few years more?
Look, I have to say that I'm enjoying, you know. We have a bigger team, and so and an excellent team, I have to say. So, you know, I feel definitely less the pressure. And, you know, when we didn't have a CEO, I was traveling the whole time to visit everybody. Now he does it. And now, of course, we have... Tim Prestidge, who, you know, also does it, they've shared the portfolio between themselves. And of course, life has changed also a little bit since COVID, because before COVID, you know, everybody used to go to the office, you know, every day. And the first 11 years of Judges, I was traveling to East Grinstead, which is an hour and a half away. And I was doing that every day. And I thought, God forbid, I mean, you don't go to work. What's this? What people have in mind? And I think now, you know, you realize it's not necessary. So I have a bit of an easier life than I had. Like, for instance, today I'm not in the office.
Okay.
And I spend more time abroad, like in the south of France. And
working, but being relaxed so you can go.
Yeah. I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased. Perfect. And I think we have, look, I think the question is not whether I'm pleased or not, because you can all, you know, everybody at my age is more vulnerable. But I think we have a really good team. And I think it's very good that we just introduced Tim, who's only 51. Yeah. And who is, you know, I think he's going to be a fantastic recruit. And he's been there 6 months. And I think it's good. We have a good team, and there's enough there for succession if I can't work, you know.
Okay.
So, and it gives me the peace of mind that I can carry on working. That's the problem, you know. Otherwise, so I'm happy for the minute.
That's very, very good to hear. So, do you have a succession plan with this kind of profiles from Halma? So we are in good hands for the future with this. Compounding profiles from very good companies, right?
Yeah, I think we have. If I became suddenly unable to work, the board would have the responsibility of defining a successor, but it would not be an urgent thing, you understand? Yep. But they may decide that they want to look outside also. I don't know. But if they don't decide, then I think we have everything we need. We have We have a team which is quite capable of doing the job. So,
okay. And they learn from you about what multiples can they pay and what are the quality businesses to go for?
They also learn from the early years of Halma.
Yeah, you know? Of course.
Because Halma was not always paying Yeah. Halma didn't become Halma by paying high prices.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very, very good compounding school, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So finally, we have a question here in our podcast that we call the Tu Dinero en Acción question, that because due to many of our listeners are investors who like to research companies and doing their own analysis of the listed companies. Could you tell us 2 to 3 companies that you like that or that would be interesting to be analyzed or you like to be investing in, apart from just Scientific, of course?
Yeah, I don't invest in a lot of companies because I don't like to sell shares, but I've sold shares twice. And of course, you know, you want to have a bit of cash and you want, you know, like, I don't want my family to suffer if suddenly I go down the tube. But, you know, I mean, look, I have some Berkshire shares, you know, it's not very original. And you know, there's proverbial companies, of course, like, Constellation. You just can't not talk about Constellation, you know.
Constellation, Berkshire, Halma, and just Scientific, and go to sleep well for years.
Halma, yeah, I know. And I think, you know, I think they're fantastic. They're all fantastic companies. I think you can do a lot worse. Okay. They're not cheap ever. Although, you know, some of these companies think they are cheap and they're buying their own shares. So, you know, and I think actually it's interesting because Berkshire, of course, you know, Warren is old. Charlie is even older. And, you know, one can think, you know, that there's a big premium on the shares because of them. And of course, if they died, then what is this premium going to do? But of course, they don't share that view because they're buying their own shares. So they feel they're cheap. And I think that if, you know, if Warren came to be incapable of working, I think the company would probably, the shares would go down, but people would, you know, they'd buy more shares. I respect his judgment that the shares are cheap. So I think it's still one of my top tips. Yeah.
Yeah. Very good things in life are not cheap or are totally free, depending on what are you talking about. And we like so much to see you at the Charlie Munger age still compounding.
I would settle for 99.5. Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much, David. So that's all from us. We hope you found the interview interesting. And I reiterate my thanks to David for agreeing with us for this recorded interview for our humble podcast. I give the floor for free for David to give us his last words before my last goodbye. And speak about you want, David.
And yeah, I don't know. And look, first, thank you for having me. It's very nice. And secondly, I wish I could have conducted the interview in Spanish. I've learned a lot of Spanish.
No problem. We'll introduce some subtitles. Don't worry at all.
I learned a lot of Spanish from my South American wife, but not enough to conduct an interview. And I would say to you, thank you for your attention. And I would say just the one thing I want to say is that we have 2 type of shareholders. We have the shareholders that we go and find, you know, because we have brokers, and brokers approach, you know, a number of, you know, institutions the whole time to try to get them interested in our shares. And we have the other people who find us. And I have to say that, you know, all the shareholders are equal, like we respect them all the same, but we have a soft touch in our heart for those who find us.
Okay, thank you so much for that.
Excellent.
Thank you all. See you next week. And thank you so much for your attention during this hour of interview with David Cicurel that I think have been very, very interesting. Thank you so much. See you next week.
Bye.